This pot smells delicious, and it's the base for our ultimate beef stew. Now we're talking about beef stew.
Beef stew.
Try this beef stew. Try this beef stew.
Yeah. Once again, welcome to another great show. Another great show. This is Big Stu, and you're now listening to Beef Stu Radio. We'll be changing the time. We won't be on Thursday night starting the new year. We'll be coming on Monday night, same time, 11:30 p.m. My host, Kappa, he's a little late today. But I have a special guest today. I have Mr. Carmichael Wolf, the electric novelist, with me. How you feel, Mr. Wolf? Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I feel great.
Yeah, so, you know, I was reading your bio, and your bio is real deep. Like, some things happened to you when you was younger. How did, like, you know, first of all, like, through the Catholic school, which a lot of people know, you know, the Catholic schools does have been priests touching children and all that stuff, and you experienced that yourself. How did that reflect and help you become a novelist being through that? Most people wouldn't become a novelist after being through a challenge like that.
Well, it helped me put certain things behind me, and then as I began to write, it gave me energy, you know, to bring certain things out and, you know, to have confidence in myself because I survived that. And in my case, it was a Catholic nun that was the one that molested me as well as several other young African-American boys. And the Catholic Church knew about it, but they failed to do anything about it. And plus, a lot of the parents were afraid to come forward because at the time, you know, the priests and the nuns were held in such high regard that you were kind of told just to look the other way. But there were priests that were active at the time as well. You know, and I had a little experience with one of the priests, but my main thing was with one nun in particular. And I could tell you that she probably molested maybe anywhere from 50 to 100 boys in the time that she was teaching, because she had full access and she could just come and take you out of any classroom that you were in and then take you to her classroom that was empty. It would just be you and her, and that's where the molestation took place.
Wow, that's crazy. Well, you know, you wrote now, and it's strange because you are able to write 3 and 4 novels at a time. You know, it's not, that's just something that people just don't do. And each novel will have a different topic. You know, what's your secret to that?
It's just a gift. And when I'm writing, I become involved in the story. So if one of the characters running, I'm running right alongside him. And one of the techniques that I use when I get ready to write is I will imagine myself sitting inside a movie theater, and I will be eating popcorn and drinking root beer soda and, you know, eating Junior Mint candies, and that's the frame of mind that I get in. And then once I start writing, I mean, it just takes over. There's a one time that I wrote from 12 noon, and then it was clear after 8 p.m., and I had never left the seat. So I wrote for 8-plus hours straight because I just got so engrossed in what I was doing that I completely lost track of time. And when I checked, I had written about 45,000 to 50,000 words just in that one setting because I blocked everything out, and then I just kept writing. So that's how I'm able to do it. Plus, when I start writing the three to four novels at a time, what I will do is I'll dedicate a certain amount of time. I'll do 2.5 hours or 3 hours on each one of them. And then I'll take a rest period anywhere from 5 to 10 to 15 minutes. And then I just get right into it.
Who influenced you to write?
I would have to say it was my mother, because she was a writer when she was younger. And when she would write, we had one of those old typewriters where you would swing the bar. So I would be standing next to her, and she would read to me from the stories that she had written. And that's what got me wanting to become a published author. And so, you know, I obviously got my ability from her, so I just carried on the tradition. And once I started writing, I just couldn't stop. So it's something that, you know, that keeps me going, and that allows me to escape certain things that happened to me in the past as far as the sexual molestation, you know, that happened with the nun. So, you know, it's a good thing, you know, because it helps me just continue to focus on the good things and to put all the other things behind me.
So what is a gangster mare? Like, I see you talk a lot about gangster mares, and, you know, you say that you was with your uncle in the 80s when the crack epidemic. And the story, and I don't mean to say it, but the story kind of seemed like your uncle might be Free Ray, Ricky Ross, or somebody to that nature, you know? So, you know, when I read up a little bit on you, so, you know, how... You know, what? How does, you know, that affect, you know, through what you've been through? What did you go through the 80s, through that? How did that affect your writing?
Oh, well, with the being involved with my uncle and his working for the CIA during the crack epidemic, it allowed me to see a lot of things that the average person wouldn't see. And I think that it's because the CIA and my uncle and the rest of the gangsters underestimated me because of my age, but I always knew that I would write about this particular thing. But I never said anything to anyone. I would just sit there and watch what they were doing. But after I left, I would take the mental notes that I had created and put them down on paper. So the Playground, which is the novel that I wrote, talks about various things that happened during the 1980s. So looking at everything that I had experienced and then, you know, taking the 1980s notes, it just allowed me to just go through and then create, you know, an unforgettable novel, something that is fresh. And, no, my uncle is not Free Ray Ricky Ross, but there were a lot of gangsters back then that did work for the CIA. And I remember, and just to back up a minute, my uncle, before he started working for the CIA, he was actually working for a Los Angeles Police Department detective, and I remember seeing the detective come up. And for those that don't know, the way that the CIA got the names of the gangsters that they could go to is from the district attorney and the Los Angeles Police Department, because we have to remember that the CIA does not normally work in the United States because they're forbidden from doing so. So when they needed to get some people that could sell their drugs for them so that they could fund their war in Central America, the Los Angeles Police Department and the district attorney provided those names. And I remember that the detective that my uncle worked for, he brought the CIA with him. And there was a handshake, drugs were exchanged, a schedule was established, and then that was it.
Wow.
So that's how that went down. And there were situations where drug dealers that worked for the CIA, let's say they were arrested at 10 a.m., by good cops. Well, by 1 p.m., they were back out on the street selling drugs to the CIA because they would go and spring them. And once they stepped in, no one could say anything, because there is a situation where an undercover cop stumbled into one of their drug operations, and they gave him up to the gangsters, and he was dispatched, which means that he was, you know, he was killed. Because when you're dealing with the CIA, if you're not a CIA member, you're expendable. And that's just the bottom line. They don't care.
So did you ever feel like your life was expendable?
No.
Just being around, you know?
I'm sorry?
Just being around your uncle and being in that life, you know, did you ever feel like your life could ever been, you know, expendable?
No, I didn't feel that way, because my uncle, I know that he could protect me, and that's the only reason why I was allowed to come around. And now, my mother didn't know anything about this, because I would go with him, and he was basically taking me, you know, to the park or whatever, because at the time, my mother was working as a nurse and as a school teacher. So if she had known about everything that was going on and that I was witnessing, she would never have allowed it to happen. And then if she had stopped it, then I could not have written this book. So I think that, you know, certain things take place in one's life that prepare them for future things that they're going to do. And I think that's why, you know, I was allowed to experience all of these things, and then nothing ever happened to me. Because, I mean, when the gangster wars started, because the CIA, they basically played both sides. They gave drugs to the Bloods and to the Crips. And the only way that you could expand your territory is by, you know, killing off those that were occupying the streets that you wanted. So my uncle, he was a member of the Five Deuce Pueblo Bishops gang, which is a notorious blood gang out in South Central Los Angeles. So, I mean, there were wars. I remember that there were gunfights every single night. And it was it had gotten so bad to where drug dealers were killing people over 10 cents because they were trying to make it to $1 million, because the CIA told them that they were working for the president, who was Ronald Reagan at the time, and that their actions were sanctioned, and they could do whatever they needed to do just to get them their money. So it was like the Wild Wild West, or like, you know, you hear about the gladiators. Well, you didn't have to turn on the television for that, because there was something going on all the time. And even the church was affected by it, because there were with the people that would go to the church to get help, but they had no idea that some of the church members themselves were addicted to drugs. So they would be beaten and robbed, and there's even an incident where a guy was sitting in the church with his family, and someone walked up to him and put a gun in his side, and he had to give up what he had, or he would have been shot and killed right in front of everyone. That's how bad it was, you know, because crack cocaine was unlike anything that had ever been seen before, and it's definitely a biological weapon because of what it did to the people. And the CIA, they knew full well what was going to happen, but they had to create these zombies, you know, so that they would only desire the crack cocaine. Because if you just smoke something once and then it's over, then you won't desire it again. But the problem with crack cocaine is that it destroyed the pleasure centers that allowed you to get that first experience. So you're walking around, even those that are still doing it 20 years later, 30 years later, they can never get that hit that they or that first experience that they got the first time that they smoked it, because those pleasure centers were destroyed the first time that you smoked it. And the same thing that happened to Amy Winehouse. That's why she couldn't kick it, even though she had all the resources in the world. It's just that it did a number on you. It turned them into, I don't know if you heard anything about what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki when the Americans dropped the atomic bomb. Okay, there's a portion in the book where one of the characters named Lucifer is talking to a group of gangsters that are from the same gang that he's from, and he's describing how there were these ant people. You would, in Japan, after the atomic bombs would drop, you would see one person walking, and all of a sudden, a group of people would just start mindlessly following that person. Well, the same thing could be said about South Central Los Angeles and crack cocaine, because there would be what they call back then, and they still call them today, base heads or strawberries, which were women that prostituted.
I'm from Harlem. We call them crackheads or heads. Yeah.
Oh, that's what you call them out there in New York, crackheads or heads?
Yeah. Basically same thing.
Okay. So you would have one person, they would say, "I see something." And all of these people would follow them, and they would be searching around on the ground for rock cocaine, but all it was, you know, natural stones or just dirt. But they were so consumed by this that they were, you know, just searching, I mean, for hours on end.
Now, did this break down the gangs? Like, you know, the crack cocaine, did it break down the anarchy and some of the gangs, the Bloods and the Crips? Did you see that?
Oh, well, you mean as far as wars between them?
And in-house, like each gang in-house, you know, when somebody gets on crack,
oh, yeah,
their decisions are not straight. Did you see a lot of personal experience in your uncle's gang where the crack had hit his own gang in-house?
Oh, yes, definitely, because there were some drug dealers, what they call big time, and once they started smoking that, I mean, they went down to nothing. There was one guy, I'm not going to say his name because he's still living. And but anyway, he was the first person to become big time. I mean, he was the first person to become a millionaire. And he was told by the CIA, do not smoke this stuff. This is not for you. This is only for the people that you are going to have as customers. Because once you smoke this, there's no coming back from it. So they knew full well what they had done, because they had scientists that created the drugs. And so he foolishly smoked it, and, I mean, he just went down to nothing. And it was a sad thing to see, because my uncle and them had looked up to him, but he lost that status once he started, you know, smoking the crack cocaine, because everything that he had just went. I mean, he just went through it, and then it was like it was a nightmare, because, you know, if you can imagine the king all of a sudden losing his mind, and then the court, you know, becomes splintered. So there was infighting between, you know, some of the gangsters, because it was a power vacuum that was created by the fall of this one guy. So, I mean, it was just like, you know, the classic movies that you see where there's wars going on and you know, and struggle and strife. So eventually a couple of the OGs, the original gangsters, like my uncle, they brought everything under control and said, we're just going to have, you know, guys that are going to control certain sections, but you're all going to report to one central figure or to a couple of central figures, because my uncle was a mid-city gangster, and the mid-city gangsters were situated across the tracks, and that's where the power structure was and still is. So those guys, you know, they basically dictated policy. And if you wanted to remain in the gang and if you wanted to live, then you had to do what they told you to do. So that's why my uncle had as much power as he had, because he had joined way back, you know, before a lot of the other people came along. And then one thing that's interesting about South Central Los Angeles is that, I mean, the crack epidemic was so bad that you had members of the Los Angeles Police Department that were standing around burning barrels, freebasing, and smoking Primos, which Primos were a mixture of rock cocaine and marijuana. And some people had the illusion that if they smoked Primos that they weren't really addicted to crack cocaine, but it was just as addictive as, you know, the regular thing, because you had crimes that would go down in the neighborhood, and the Los Angeles Police Department, they were so high that they couldn't even react to it. People were being shot in front of them. You know, they were being shot in front of them, and they just look over, and they have the crack pipe in their mouth and just smoking it. And wow. It was just, that's, you know, the type of situation that rock cocaine set up. But before that happened, I mean, the black community, it was a sprawling area. I mean, you had people for miles. A lot of people were going to church. I remember there were women that had worked for Department of Water and Power. Once they started smoking that crack cocaine, all of their knowledge that they had, it just went. Their self-esteem, you know, they were just, you would just see them. They became grotesque beasts overnight. I mean, they were beauty queens at one time, but this biological weapon, it was so destructive that it just changed their entire physical appearance and their entire outlook on life. And then eventually they went to go live on what they call Skid Row, where all of the homeless people, you know, live, and where a lot of those people that were let out of the mental institutions because of Reaganomics went. So that's where many of them are today, because they smoked that rock cocaine and they just could not overcome it.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, we're talking to Mr. Carmichael Wolf, the electric novelist.
The eclectic
you know, the electric, myself, my bad. You know what I'm saying? You know, you talked about, and one of your characters is a young lady, the daughter from Hong Kong, is the president's daughter. A young lady from Hong Kong is one of the leaders, is the president's daughter from Hong Kong, one of your characters. Can you, you know, talk a little more about that? Where did you get, you know, because that's deep. Is that something that came through your experience from, you know, being around the CIA, or that's just something you thought of and just wrote about it?
No, it came from the experience, because there are a few that know that the drugs lead to the White House, and that past presidents have made money off of it. I mean, this goes all the way back to when the CIA was running operations in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a well-known fact in the certain black communities, or in certain, even in the white areas where you have the white supremacists, the Aryan Brotherhoods, and so on and so forth. They know that the money leads to the White House. And I remember seeing certain high-profile individuals, you know, come into the neighborhood wearing suits. And, you know, it was whispered that they were connected with certain people in Washington. And so this is where that comes from. It's just the knowledge that there are a lot of people that are in the black areas that you wouldn't expect to be there because of their status. And, yes, it does lead to the White House. I'm not talking about the present administration, but the past Republican administrations,
mm-hmm.
especially when mm-hmm. Ronald Reagan was in office. This is what this is all based on in the 80s when he was in charge, because he was the one that sanctioned the CIA's activity.
Mm-hmm.
So at that time, yes, the money was leading there, and that's why you hear certain people talk about how his wife was seen, I believe it was in the Oakland area, buying crack cocaine. I mean,
wow.
There were big-name singers that were seen in the area, and I know you remember who Todd Bridges is, right?
Yeah, Todd Bridges, yep.
Willis. And how he got... Right, and how he got into a fight with a gang member that they say was trying to rob him.
Yeah.
Well, the area where that happened is one of the, they're a rival gang that was trying to gain territory that my uncle's gang was fighting against, because the CIA gave them drugs and they gave the Bloods drugs as well. So the Crips and the Bloods, they were always at war because of the drugs. I mean, there was wars before. But once the crack cocaine was introduced, the black community.
The money wars.
Right, the money wars. It became the valley of the shadow of death for African Americans once the gangsters went to war with one another. So it was unlike anything that you had ever seen before. And all it was about was, you know, the president at the time, Ronald Reagan, accusing the Cubans of trying to take over certain territory. And what's not known about South Central Los Angeles is that there were Cuban nationals that were in South Central Los Angeles at the time, and that were trying to warn the blacks and the other Hispanics that were there that were a part of the drug trade as well, because they knew about the war. But, you know, if you don't know world politics and you living in a, you know, a small area that's isolated, you won't know where the money is going or why you're killing one another over it, or why these guys all of a sudden show up in suits that never gave a damn about you, and now they're offering you an opportunity to work for the president, and they're telling you that all your actions are sanctioned. So basically they were given carte blanche to kill as many people as they needed to in order to get the drugs. And I remember situations where people would come into the neighborhood and they would pretend to want to buy drugs, and they were Crips in disguise. And they would open fire on the Bloods and take the drugs and the money that they had on them. And this was all sparked by this war and each side being told that they had the authority from the president to do whatever they had to do to get the money. So,
wow.
Yes, it does lead, or it did lead to the White House. I'm not sure about the Obama administration. He seems on the up and up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that this present administration is involved, but I know that the Republicans were.
Well, I see you got you spell something T-O-G-T-G-O. What, you know, to explain to the audience, what does that mean?
Well, that's the Organization of Gangsters, Thieves, and Government Officials. And this is the organization that I'm talking about, where you have the high-profile individuals, I mean politicians and the gangsters, and that also involves local and federal law enforcement. And this is a real organization, because these drug wars and this drug dealing to fund wars around the planet is still going on. The 80s was just, you know, that was the biggest operation that had ever been carried out. Because in the 50s, the military-industrial complex, as they're known, are the military guys, they had blacks running drugs for them in the black areas, but it was not on the same scale as the 80s. And the drugs that they were running was heroin. I mean, you could get off of that and you could still function, you know, to a certain extent. But with rock cocaine, there was no functionality. You just lost every bit of yourself. And this organization, the Organization of Gangsters, Thieves, and Government Officials, outlines the coordinated effort of all of these parties to use the black community to fund their drug wars. Because that's basically what all these wars are about. The ones in Central America, people are also making money off of the heroin in Afghanistan. That's all tied to this same thing, because the people that were there, the Taliban, they outlawed drugs.
Mm-hmm.
But all of a sudden, once the United States went in there and started the war, the drug lords came back, and now people are making money off of the heroin when they had stopped that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all about the drugs, and it's always been about the drugs, and it always will be about the drugs, and it's always going to be some greedy Americans that are possessed by demonic forces and that hate humanity that's going to fuel the wars in the neighborhoods and around this entire planet, because there's a lot of stuff that's going on in Africa right now, too, where the CIA is controlling certain factions and having them war with one another. Because in Somalia, for example, they destabilized, they took away the government, and now they're fighting over certain ports.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, I mean, it's, and you think about this. You have a drug that debuts in South Central Los Angeles, and all of a sudden, this same drug is found in South Africa, it's found in the East End.
With 12 and 8-year-olds are smoking it now, too. You know,
exactly.
In terms of, 12, 8-year-old, 7-year-old kids, that's what they eat. But
exactly.
you also say that in the 4K tech, the war is going to be fought different. Like, do you believe in extraterrestrials? Because it seems like you're right, like you believe in extraterrestrials. And
oh, yes.
You believe that the future. You know, explain to the audience about that. I wanted to get into that before, the show was over, because that seems deep, too.
Yes, I do believe in extraterrestrials. And it's not because someone has told me something. It's because I've had personal experiences, certain things that I've seen. And, South Central Los Angeles, and Los Angeles in particular, is an isolated area. But there has been extraterrestrial sightings there and extraterrestrial contact. And I talked about the 4K technology because that's what's being developed right now. But eventually the extraterrestrials are going to give the CIA and the U.S. government the ability to transport things to, let's say, I talked about as far as, like, hospitals. They will be able to transport an entire emergency room to where they can perform operations there and then transport that material back. Plus, they will be able to, if there's a certain person like Hugo Chavez that they want, they will be able to just go in there and it will be like magic, and they will be able to teleport that person to wherever they want to send him to. And this is what's coming. There are some people that, may not believe it, but yes, it's definitely coming, because this technology that we're getting is from the extraterrestrials. Because when you think about the vacuum tube, you cannot go from the vacuum tube to the microchip, because it generally takes human beings at least 18 months to develop technology. But we made a quantum leap, from vacuum tube to the microchip, and then now here we are dealing with nanotechnology. Now, the reason I'm telling you this about the hospitals or the emergency rooms is because this is exactly what the extraterrestrials use right now when they conduct these alien abductions, where they take people and they perform experiments on them. They have a way of transporting the material from the place that it is stored to our dimension. So that's what's basically going to happen. So yes, it will be 4K technology that's already here, that's going to be coupled with the more advanced technology that they're going to be given.
Okay.
And so
you said some remarkable
things.
Okay, sorry to cut you off.
No, go ahead.
This is deep too. One more thing. You made a statement. You said, "I died for 45 minutes at the age of 17, and I came back and knew who exactly who I was, even in death." Before, we got a little few minutes before the show go off. I just want you to get into that before we close the show.
Okay, sure. Yes, I did dive for 45 minutes. I had contracted Legionnaire's disease working in a particular place, and I had, you know, had been sick, and then I went to the hospital, and while I was in the hospital, I heard the doctor out there with my mother telling her that there was no hope. So while this was transpiring, I could tell that something was going on. So all of a sudden, everything that I had ever experienced started flashing before my eyes. It was like a movie. But one thing I noticed is that I was not in that movie. I could see my cat named Snowball. I could see my vehicle. I could see my home. And then next thing you know, I started feeling myself lifting off. So it was like if you've been on a 757, you know exactly what I'm talking about. That's how it feels when you leave your body. You're lifting off like that. And then next thing you know, I was on the ceiling, and I could see the tether attached to me. So I was struggling to get back into my body for 45 minutes because I remember looking at the time on the clock when I first lifted up out of my body. So each time I tried to get back into my body, I was just bouncing off of it like it was concrete. Finally, once I got back into my body, I could feel the blood started to circulate again, but it was 45 minutes that my mom and the doctor were outside the room and that I was in there struggling to try to get back into my body. And I think that since I was 17, you know, and your spirit is strong, that's the only way that I was able to do it. But had I been, you know, maybe a 60-year-old man or something like that, I doubt that I would have been able to come back. But I had a desire to live, and it's obvious that I had some stuff that I was supposed to do here, because after I came back, I went 5 years straight without even a single cold.
Wow.
And that's something that had never happened to me before.
Well, once again, ladies and gentlemen, we had your man Carmichael Wolf on there. It's been a real exciting interview. You want to tell people where they can get your books at real quick before we sign off?
Yes, you can purchase my book through my website, which is Carmichael Wolf, The Eclectic Novelist. Novelist spelled NOVLST.com. You can also go to Amazon.com and pick it up, or Barnes & Noble, or Books A Million, and the ISBN number is 160-844-7669. It retails for $29.99, and there are some sites that are giving you a discount. Plus, it's available through the Android Marketplace in electronic form for $14.37.
All right. But thank you for being on the show, brother.
Thank you for having me. You have a good night.
All right. You too. Once again, everybody, this is Beef Stew Radio. I want to say Happy New Year. You know, this was a great interview with Mr. Carmichael Wolf. I want to thank him. It was deep. You know, other people, we know that there's other people out there other than Ricky Ross that have been involved with that whole crack epidemic. I wanted to bring that to y'all. The new year is going to be great. We won't be on no more on Thursdays. We're going to be on Mondays now, 11:30 p.m., same time, but just on Monday night. The Pretty Smiles contest, we will be announcing the winner on January 2nd. So everybody on Facebook that, you know, participated in that, be looking forward to see if it was you. Once again, my man Kappa, he's not here today. I wish everybody a Happy New Year's. I'll see y'all. We won't be on next week. We'll be on the following Monday with a great, great interview. Once again, it is Beef Stew Radio, stirring up the best talk on the radio, you know what I'm saying, on the net, as a matter of fact. For on behalf of me and my partner Kappa, I'm going to wish everybody once again Happy New Year's, to wish your family to prosper, and here we go, we out, Beef Stew Radio.
This pot smells delicious, and it's the base for an ultimate beef stew.
Beef Stew Radio.
Now we're talking about beef stew.
Beef Stew Radio. Try this beef stew.
Beef.
Two.
Three.